The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles, first from the Harvard Heart Letter, and probably from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter as well. This is the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2022. And the first article I'm going to read is the initial article, which is entitled "The Dirt on Soil and Water Pollution." Heavy metals, pesticides, and microplastics may affect your risk for cardiovascular disease. Can you limit your exposure to these toxins? The word pollution often conjures up clouds of noxious gases billowing from a factory smokestack or a vehicle tailpipe. But while many people are now aware of air pollution's harmful effects on cardiovascular health, the impact of soil and water pollution remains largely unrecognized. A review article published online June 30, 2022, by Cardiovascular Research details the main contaminants found in soil and water and the threats they pose to the cardiovascular system. We wrote this paper to encourage cardiologists to consider environmental factors that might affect their patients' risk, says co-author Dr. Philip Landrigan, adjunct professor of environmental health at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and an affiliate in the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Soil pollutants enter the body when people eat crops grown in dirty soil, drink water contaminated by dirty soil, or inhale soil dust. Heavy metals, especially lead, cadmium, and arsenic, are the most pressing concerns, says Dr. Landrigan, whose early work fueled the banning of lead in gasoline and paint in the mid-1970s. Because of lead's detrimental effect on brain development, babies and young children are particularly vulnerable to lead exposure. But even low blood level, however, even low blood lead levels at concentrations previously assumed to be safe in adults have been linked to an increased risk of high blood pressure and heart disease. Lead disrupts the normal blood vessel function through a process called oxidative stress and also promotes damaging inflammation. Residue from lead paint persists in homes and other structures built before 1978, and erosion from lead pipes, mainly in homes built before 1986, can contaminate drinking water. Like lead, cadmium, that's C-A-D-M-I-U-M, persists in the environment and has similar unfavorable effects on cardiovascular health. According to an editorial published in the May 18, 2021, in the Journal of the American Heart Association, elevated cadmium levels in blood and urine are associated with higher cardiovascular disease risk. Industrial use of cadmium, such as in batteries, solar panels, and plastics, has led to widespread soil contamination. Arsenic awareness. Similar, albeit less certain, heart-related risks have been observed with arsenic, especially in people who consume arsenic-contaminated drinking water. But this heavy metal appears to have another, more insidious health effect. Arsenic exposure early in life can cause changes in gene expression that enhance heart-related risks in adulthood. Of particular concern is rice grown in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, where the fields retain residues of lead arsenate pesticide sprayed on cotton crops 50 or more years ago. Rice extracts arsenic out of the soil, and most rice cereal fed to babies is made with American-grown rice. The FDA has yet to finalize limits for arsenic or cadmium in baby food. Pesticides. People who work in agricultural and chemical industries face the greatest exposure to pesticides. But people living in rural agricultural areas can be affected by these chemicals as well. And the general public may consume pesticide residues in food. Other farming practices, including deforestation and over-fertilization, can degrade soil health, reducing crop productivity and polluting water supplies. How much plastic waste escapes into the oceans each year? Picture 5 garbage bags of plastic trash on every meter of the coastline around the entire world. This waste, about a third of which is single-use plastic, slowly breaks down into tiny particles after a prolonged exposure to waves, wind, and sunlight. The resulting microplastic and even tinier nanoplastic particles travel from seawater to pollute fish, shellfish, air, and soil, eventually entering many parts of the food supply. There aren't any population studies looking at the cardiovascular health effects of nano and microplastics in humans, but these particles can reach the bloodstream, making it plausible that they could travel to different organs and cause systemic and cardiovascular disease, according to Dr. Landergan. Soil and water pollution poses a bigger threat to people in low and middle income countries because of their greater exposure to contaminants. However, the increasing globalization of our food supply chains means this problem now affects everyone. But there are a few things you can do that may help make a difference. And the article goes on to list 3 things that you can do to limit your pollution exposure. And those things are, 1, check your drinking water. By law, drinking water suppliers in the United States must provide customers with an annual water quality report. If you're among the more than 40 million Americans whose water comes from a private well, you should use the link www.epa.gov/private wells. If your drinking water contains heavy metals or other contaminants, use one of the major water filter brands and be sure to replace the filter per the instructions. Otherwise, drink tap water. It's not just cheaper, it's kinder to the environment. Consider buying organic food. Only foods labeled as USDA certified organic are grown and processed according to guidelines that address soil quality and other factors. Organic food tends to be more expensive than conventionally produced food. The price difference has been shrinking as organic production has become more widespread. If cost is a concern, choose organic only for foods that you eat most often. Finally, you should minimize your plastic use. Avoid using plastic, especially single-use plastic, as much as possible. Only about 10% of plastic waste is actually recycled. Now we're going to turn to an article again from the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2022. And this is from Dr. Deepak L. Bhatt, B-H-A-T-T. He's the editor-in-chief. And he answers the question, what is a bubble study? Dr. Bott, I recently had a minor stroke. I have fully recovered. My doctor now wants to do a bubble study. What is this and why is it done? And Dr. Bott replies, a bubble study, which is done during an echocardiogram, can provide added information about blood flow through your heart. Doctors often do bubble studies on people who experience an unexpected stroke. That is, those who have no obvious stroke risk, like high blood pressure or atrial fibrillation. The results can provide clues about a possible cause and may affect the treatment you receive. During the test, a technician injects a solution into a vein in your arm. This fluid contains tiny bubbles of air, which then circulate through your bloodstream to the right side of your heart. You'll be asked to cough or bear down, which briefly increases the pressure in the heart's right side. On the ultrasound image, the bubbles can be seen traveling into the heart's upper chamber, then down to the lower chamber called the ventricle, and then out through the pulmonary artery to the lungs, where they are filtered out of the blood. In some people, though, bubbles are seen traveling through a tiny, flap-like tunnel between the right and the left atrium. This opening is present in all babies as a normal part of development and usually closes up within a few weeks of birth. But in about 25% of people, the hole does not fully close and is known as a patent foramen ovale, or PFO. For the most part, this is a harmless condition, and most people with PFOs don't even know they have one. Some PFOs may be responsible for certain rare strokes, which are thought to happen when a blood clot travels between the right and left atrium. Because the clot bypasses the lungs, which trap tiny clots before blood recirculates, it can travel to the brain, lodge in a blood vessel, and cause a stroke. To better assess the odds of this happening, you may also receive a transcranial Doppler study in conjunction with the bubble study. This special ultrasound of the brain's vessels can show if the bubbles injected into your vein are moving all the way up to the brain. When that's the case, the PFO may be more likely to cause a stroke. PFOs could be at fault in some so-called cryptogenic strokes, those with no clear cause, especially in people who are 60 and younger. For these people, if testing shows a PFO, doctors sometimes recommend a procedure to close the opening, especially if it is large. But for most people, clot-preventing drugs are the initial treatment. Now we're continuing with the Harvard Heart Letter, and we're going to go next to an article that's entitled, A Virtual Approach to Healing the Heart. Cardiac rehab via a computer or smartphone enables you to get targeted support from the comfort of your home. If you've had a heart attack or other serious cardiovascular issue, cardiac rehabilitation is hands down the best way to prevent future heart problems. This program, which teaches the fundamentals of heart-healthy habits, coupled with supervised exercise, normally takes place in person during hour-long sessions several times a week over the course of several months. Cardiac rehab is recommended for many conditions and can reduce your risk of dying of heart disease by nearly 25%. Unfortunately, only about 20% of people who qualify for cardiac rehab actually participate in these programs. One of the main reasons is the hassle of traveling to the sessions. even in urban areas. And for most people who live in rural areas where rehab centers are few and far between, attending multiple weekly sessions simply isn't feasible. But a trend to move some of cardiac rehab to a virtual delivery system has been ramping up over the past few years, says cardiologist Dr. Amy Bott, associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and chief innovation officer for the American College of Cardiology. The original concept of cardiac rehab, bringing people together to learn in a group setting, has many benefits. Yes, it's an efficient way to teach people about nutrition and medication management. But groups also help people with shared experiences, process the emotional aspects of coping with heart disease. Enabling people to connect remotely to the teaching and support sessions from home may also offer other advantages. Virtual cardiac rehab lets people avoid not only time and travel costs, but also the potential anxiety of having to return to the hospital or facility where they were treated for their heart problems, which upsets some people. After a heart-related health scare, people often worry they'll have another heart problem, and these automatic negative thoughts can be quite debilitating. But stress and resiliency training delivered via video conference can be incredibly helpful, says Dr. Bott, who recently co-authored a study showing the benefits of such training in adults who were born with heart disease. Another key thing people learn about in cardiac rehab, how to improve their eating habits, might even be more instructive via a live video visit than conventional rehab. When you're connected virtually, you can let the nutritionist or dietitian look around your kitchen and pantry to see what you're eating. They might say, "Hey, you know, there's a low-salt version of that product that might be great for you." On-site exercise assessment. Of course, the initial cardiac rehab visit has to be in person. It typically involves an assessment of your risk for heart disease and an exercise stress test, during which you exercise on a treadmill or stationary bike while being closely monitored. You'll get an individualized treatment plan with goals for your blood pressure, your blood sugar, your heart rate and weight. Also, information about smoking cessation. It's comfortable to have a nurse nearby assuring you that everything looks good when you're exercising, Dr. Bott says. But after learning what intensity and amount of exercise is right for them, most people are fine to exercise on their own, either at home or at a gym. Some rehab programs even supply devices, like heart rate monitors and blood pressure cuffs, for at-home monitoring. So far, research suggests that virtual cardiac rehab compares favorably with conventional rehab in terms of keeping people out of the hospital and improving quality of life. A handful of companies have already created digital platforms to deliver virtual cardiac rehab and are partnering with large medical centers or major insurance companies. If you qualify for cardiac rehab, ask your cardiologist about virtual rehab or if he or she would be willing to help you create some sort of blended program, says Dr. Bott. And there's a additional very brief section that's entitled, "Am I eligible for cardiac rehab?" Cardiac rehab programs are appropriate for the following conditions if you have a referral from your doctor. And the list includes current stable angina, a heart attack in the past 12 months, coronary angioplasty or stent placement, coronary artery bypass surgery, a heart valve repair or a replacement, stable chronic heart failure, and finally, heart transplant or heart-lung transplant. Now we're going to continue with the Harvard Heart Letter of October 2022. And I'm reading an article entitled, More Protection for Your Heart? It's Just a Shot Away. You can lower your risk for heart attack, stroke, and death from heart disease by staying current on your vaccinations. With all the attention on COVID-19 vaccines in the last 2 years, you may have neglected to receive other routine vaccines recommended for older adults, like the influenza, pneumonia, and shingles vaccine. But if you have heart disease or are at risk for it, these shots are important. And early fall is a great time to get back on schedule. Earlier this year, a large study confirmed that flu vaccine may help lower the risk of serious cardiovascular complications. The risk of heart attack and stroke rises in the year following a bout of either pneumonia or shingles. Remember that shingles is a reawakening of the chickenpox virus that emerges through the nerves and causes a painful rash. Vaccines can help lower these risks. COVID puts an important and renewed focus on the link between infections and cardiovascular disease, says Dr. Ann Keat S. Bott, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Even a mild COVID-19 infection can raise a person's risk of heart problems. But physicians have long known that serious infections, especially the flu, can leave people more vulnerable to a heart attack, heart failure, and dying from heart disease. When you have any type of infection, your body releases molecules called cytokines, which stimulate your immune system to combat the offending pathogen. This response can affect the cardiovascular system via two different pathways, Dr. Bott explains. Cytokines can depress the heart's ability to pump normally. The resulting immune response also seems to be involved in accelerating the buildup of plaque inside the arteries. Influenza. A yearly flu shot may lower your risk of catching the disease roughly by half. The CDC recommends getting the vaccine in September or October. Several different types of flu shots are available. If you're 65 or older, three vaccines, the Fluzone high-dose quadrivalent, the Flublok quadrivalent recombinant, and the Fluad quadrivalent adjuvanted may offer slightly better protection than the regular dose and are the preferred choice. Pneumonia. This year, the FDA approved two new pneumonia vaccines, PCV20 or Prevnar 20 and PCV15 or Vaxneuvance. They replace PCV13 and PPSV23. The CDC now recommends that people age 65 or older, as well as adults younger than 65, at high risk for pneumonia should get a single dose of PCV20 and a dose of PCV15, followed a year later by a dose of the older vaccine, PPSV23. Then there is shingles. Everyone 50 and older should get two doses of the shingles vaccine called Shingrix, Shingrix. They're given 2 to 6 months apart. You should still get this vaccine even if you don't know if you had chickenpox or not, you've already had the shingles, and even if you got the earlier shingle vaccine, Zostavax, which is no longer available in the United States. Now we're going to read a couple of briefer articles called Research We're Watching. The first one is called Weekend Warrior Exercise Patterns. Do you like squeezing all your weekly exercise into just 1 or 2 days? From a health standpoint, that practice may be just as effective as spreading your exercise out over an entire week. Researchers used data from nearly 351,000 adults who reported their exercise habits from 1997 to 2013. They then divided participants based on whether and when during the week they meet federal exercise guidelines. At least 150 minutes of modern physical activity, or at least 75 minutes of vigorous activity per week. Those who didn't meet the guidelines were called inactive. Those who did and who spread their activity through the week were called regularly active. And those who did all their activity in 1 or 2 days were called weekend warriors. When research linked that data to information from the National Death Index, they found no difference in overall death rate or deaths from specific causes among the two active groups. People who get recommended levels of physical activity may experience similar benefits regardless of when they do their workouts. This was the researchers' conclusion. Their findings were published in the August 2022 issue of the JAMA Internal Medicine Journal. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.